Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, another, I hope to be great, and probably the last of the extra-long shows that we've been lucky to get. After this week, we'll go to our normal 2 hours, but this week we will be still getting that extra half hour. And I'm going to be talking about the ABCs of creating virtue. It's kind of a very much, you could say, one of those shows where I can really say this is like, how do you do it kind of thing. I know that's not the most relevant subject to everything else I talk about, but in the bottom line of things, for most listeners, that probably is a critical element of what I talk about. And if it's not, if it can't be applied in some way, one has to question talking about things that, you know, are, we'll say, extremely hidden or esoteric, but not applicable, having a little change to either people, the world, the outcome of the creation of more of our Creator here in this dimension in time and space. Those things are probably what I am trying to get to, and hopefully I am doing that. And it's required that, effectively, all of you out there get some kind of help in being able to apply that which you hear. Now, you could say, well, if you're just teaching, why can't you just teach about abstract things and people can figure it out for themselves, or maybe they won't be interested in doing anything about what they're hearing. Well, that's true. Nonetheless, I think to be, we'll say, true to what the principles are that I'm getting other people to buy into, the show itself has to, at the same time, provide some of this characteristic in every show, if possible, and I try to do that. And in tonight's show, particularly, I figure, hey, we got an extra half hour. Okay. And this is the kind of pragmatic show that a lot of people have been asking for, and a lot of the time I consider it, but then I say, well, I am putting little pieces in here and there. At the same time, then there's the problem of somebody saying, well, which show do I listen to find that out? Okay, well, there's a lot of them, right? And, you know, hundreds and hundreds. So the even I can't say, well, go to show number such and such, and there it is, because even though I'm doing talking, I don't necessarily remember every show in some linear or mathematical alignment to the other shows, being able to say, go to this one. I can kind of do that with the textbook I wrote, but still, I mean, even that, 700 plus pages, you know, it's huge. And it's not so easy even in that spectrum, but when each show could represent one of those textbooks in its breadth of, we'll say, words, if nothing else, then it gets into the question of, okay, how are you going to ever do that? You can't. So now I could say, well, there's the ABCs of creating virtue if you're interested in that particular line of thought. So this is another good reason to be applying tonight's show. Let's talk about what I mean by creating virtue. Virtue is the thought of God applied or part of the dimensional time, space, and matter, which in this case is energy and matter, of this dimension while we're here. When you go to another dimension of time and space to live in, you can create virtue in that time and space, but virtually none can be created in this one any longer. So this is the time while you're here to create virtue here. And that's what I'm going to predominantly be thinking about, talking about. Now, I've had shows where I've covered this in general for all the dimensions and that sort of stuff. Tonight, it's going to be right here, right now, and it's going to be about all the different kinds of people at their varying levels and the types of problems they may face. So we can get into the nitty-gritty with many different examples, because there's no one answer to the ABCs of creating virtue. There's almost an infinite number of specifics, but there's a range in each of the specifics that people fall into. So I'm going to be dealing with that, those categories or ranges, which still is going to be quite a few. That will be of some assistance. Virtue, again, is our Creator's own thought applied to some form, and in this case, the energy and matter of this realm, this dimension that we exist in, the physical, etheric and physical, or electromagnetic and physical parts of where we live right now. In order to enlighten something, anything, it needs to become the following. It has to integrate better in time and space. Integration in time and space means that it brings time and space closer together rather than separating them and creating forces as a result. So it has to reduce force. It needs to integrate time and space. And it has to approach what some people would call less effort, and hopefully, if it is fully enlightened, which is a very difficult place to get to, that if the whatever energy is used becomes effortless. Now, in order for energy to be effortless, it has to be continually enlightening the space that it exists within. It's a constant state of existence. That's no easy job to do. And for humans, it requires that the senses of the humans, first of all, become enlightened. Then the knowledge of the humans needs to be enlightened. Well, the information coming in from the senses needs to be enlightened. And knowledge needs to be enlightened, that the information is converted into by the human. And then eventually, consciousness has to be enlightened, which is the ability to take the knowledge and create, expand it into many other areas that the specifics of the knowledge do not necessarily apply to. So, and oftentimes you create a whole bunch of new kinds of categories of knowledge and other things in that process. That this whole thing that we are talking about tonight is revolving around the things I just talked about, senses, and information, and creating knowledge, and eventually consciousness. Although there's two sides of the consciousness, you could say that consciousness is created or grown, if you follow the principles I'm saying. But also, you could theoretically, it is possible, to grow consciousness without even going through those steps, although that is much more difficult to do, because in most circumstances, consciousness grows as a result, even though it's a further cause of, those prior conditions. However, I will give you some examples in tonight's show of consciousness that grows without them. So it's important to realize that it's one of the unique things in the universe that consciousness, or the understanding, ultimately, of God, can come from two sides of the fence. It comes from understanding God, that's without reservation, and it comes from co-creating with God, which requires the other things that I just mentioned. So you've got a dual pattern, a dual highway for developing consciousness. You can just understand God and grow your consciousness without co-creating with God. However, to become fully enlightened, you have to do both. You have to do both, and they must be balanced. And balance means they are equal to each other to become fully enlightened. You can create some light in yourself and help others to do the same, and in the world around you, by using either one of these methods, understanding and or co-creating. But if you want to create a fully enlightened state, you must do both, and they must be balanced. So those are good definitions. Those are good ways of looking at how the, we'll say, the basis of the we'll say, more nutsy and boltsy things that we're going to talk about can be explained. And it's definitely, as we usually do, a definition as well. Now, some people have given different definitions for the same kinds of things I'm talking about. However, if you go deeper into most of them, you will find, not everyone, but most, that the deeper way of looking at it is the way I just described. So there's a more, there are more superficial ways of describing it, but I haven't found any yet that are deeper. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't any. I'm just saying in my ability to teach or my ability to understand the situation, this is as far as you go in getting to the bottom line of what it all means in a definitive sense. There's still the whole rest of the show dealing with the pragmatic events of that, but it's, you know, it's good for us to start with the big concept, and that's certainly the big concept there. All right, now when I say ABCs, the inference is that it is relatively pragmatic and simple to follow, and that's what I am trying to get at tonight. Oh, you can say, well, but the first 10 minutes have been grueling. You're talking about these, you know, big things. Okay, yeah, that's how I start every show. I figure you're fresh enough in your mind to be able to maybe follow it, you know. And I do that all the time. Don't worry. Tonight's going to be a lot less of the big stuff and a lot more of the ABCs. So that's what the show's going to be about. It's going to be about that, for sure. But nonetheless, I like to start with the big picture, so to speak, and get to the huge concepts right in the beginning so that people who have any ability that they can muster to understand what I'm saying will do so. As I realize, I may lose some people. That's okay, and that's not a judgment here. If you don't understand it, that's you dummies, you don't understand. No, I get it. First of all, if you haven't ever heard the show before, for sure this is going to sound like, whoa, where's this guy coming from? If you heard it before, some of this is going to like, you're going to say, well, I even figured that one out for myself, or I've heard you say it before. Those kinds of responses are, I hope, going to be in the majority, but I never know. All right, so by ABCs, I mean the following. That for each kind or group of people that I'm going to be addressing, so to speak, and this is really about levels of both consciousness, willingness to co-create, and opportunity. So you put all those three together, and that's what the situation entails as far as category is concerned. And some people might say, well, what about intelligence? Well, intelligence has to do with the ability to understand and create knowledge, which is not a bad thing. And I think that intelligence plays a role in this whole thing. But strangely, not as much as you might think. As we go through the show, I'll exemplify how that may be true. The other thing to recognize here is both intelligence and prior knowledge are far less important than is the will to co-create, or consistency, or choice to co-create with God, to be a creator of God's mind and form, create virtue. If you're not willing to do that, it doesn't really matter how intelligent you are, how knowledgeable you are. It's an irrelevant issue, actually, and that we'll talk about that more. But in addition, it also is a conclusionary issue with me that if people don't have opportunity because of prior karma, which may even be in a prior lifetime, or usually in this lifetime, they're denied the the opportunity to create as much virtue as they would be doing otherwise. That is a peculiar and definite real issue. I'll talk about that and explain how there's ways around it. And then the last part of it is a general consciousness in general. And let me start off, and now I'm going to be moving sort of towards the practical side, because I want to get as much in the show today as I can along this line, to tell you that most people have a level of consciousness, and this is the kind of consciousness I call soul consciousness, which is the consciousness of their creator, God consciousness, that falls somewhere between 1 and 2%. What? Yeah. 1 or 2% of the maximum level that is possible for a human being to have. Now, there's another side to it. They can have consciousness which doesn't deal with God. I call that personal consciousness or little self-consciousness. They share that kind of consciousness, the personality, which is the subconscious part of us, and the conscious part of us, which is lower self, the little self. That can be anywhere from as much as 10 times greater, much as 10 times greater, to as little as 2 or 3. Okay. But that doesn't change the level of the ability to create virtue. Why not? Because all of that consciousness goes towards a selfish motive within the person. Yeah, they might do some nice things for other people, maybe help other people become a little bit more selfish by giving them things that they probably don't deserve and will abuse or destroy in some way. But it doesn't grow God consciousness in them to do that, and or the people they're helping. And at the same time, it detracts from their total, we'll say, capability to create God consciousness, because there is a limitation in time, energy, and opportunity. And those all get wasted. They all get wasted when someone is being selfish. And the result, we call it mistakes, but they waste. And so the result is that having a higher personal consciousness, let's say someone is at 15 or 16%, that's a lot, but they're only at 1.6% of God consciousness or soul consciousness. It doesn't matter what you use the name. So 1.6% of the time that they are awake or conscious, they use that consciousness to either understand and or co-create more of God, which we call creating virtue, 1.6%. And that would mean that the rest of the time that they are actually conscious, which may not be every minute they're awake, by the way, but let's say it were, that would be 98.4% of the time they are selfish. And those numbers may sound ludicrous, but I'm telling you that the average is in that ballpark for people living right here in the United States or any other country similar to the United States. There are some exceptions to this. If you go into the most primitive parts of the world, this number has some strange skews to it. And if I have time, I'll talk about that. But it's so rare today, it's probably not worth almost mentioning. And I doubt those people have the technology to even be listening to me. So, I mean, it's a kind of a strange thing, not to exclude them. And in some ways, they can could actually be of higher soul consciousness. So it's a strange set of circumstances. Again, the exceptions are interesting but may not be relevant, since today is the ABCs. And ABCs means you can apply it, and I don't know if it makes much difference if you know about people who can't or in some way do weird things with their consciousness by our standards. Okay, so the interesting factor here is when we look at these numbers and how it works out, there's a lot of room for improvement. I mean, a huge amount. And if that's around where the average is, holy moly. Most people are barely functioning as a soul, barely. And so that is a great area that they can grow in. Now, why would you want to do that? I mean, seriously, I mean, granted, it sounds like a great plan, an idea. I want to create more light in the world. I want to be creating virtue, just like Niles is saying on the radio. Sounds great to me until I hang up tonight or until I turn off my computer, either one. But you know what? An hour later, you'll be just as probably selfish as you were before, unless tonight's show really does make a difference with you, and I hope it will. But here's the fact that I'm trying to get to, at least my suggested fact. This is for all of you to determine for yourselves eventually. But here is the bottom line from my perspective. If you're that low in consciousness, you're also low in your ultimate meaning in life. Now, I say ultimate. What does that mean? Well, you can gain meaning by being selfish for a while. You know that? Yeah, you can. You do it all the time. We all do it. Here's how you do it. You grow the self, the little self, in relationship to the personality. So you become less subconscious and more self-conscious. Or we'll say conscious with the self. Because we use the word self-conscious, meaning, well, I'm feeling weird about myself around people or something. That's not what I mean by self-conscious. So you could do that up to a certain point, and the point is the number I gave you. So you could constantly be increasing your little self and decreasing your personal or subconscious part of you up to, 6 times more, maybe, you know, or more of that, but at least that much, 7, 8 times more, than your level of soul consciousness. And therefore, during that time that you're increasing consciousness, by definition, meaning comes from an increase in relative consciousness compared to where it was before. So if you can keep increasing your personal consciousness, life becomes more meaningful. But the caveat comes in. Eventually, the door closes on how much you can increase your personal consciousness and ignore developing your consciousness about or of your soul and God. Ooh, how come? Well, it's a little bit esoteric. Let's try to go through the numbers and explain it. The principle is the following. As we increase our personal consciousness, although it also means, in my definition, increasing our lower self-consciousness, which may decrease our personal consciousness overall. But to the personality, it's one and the same because it doesn't mind itself, the lower self, growing in consciousness as long as it still feels like it's in control of some of that. So it's sort of like you're on a leash. But you can, that's a good deal for the personality because it figures, oh yeah, you can go and increase it. You want to be a better piano player. You want to be a better musician. You want to be a better artist. You want to be a better mechanic. You want to be a better friend. You want to be a better anything. It doesn't matter. All of those things relate to a self-interest, right? And the difference between the one to the other, the lower self to the personality, can only grow to the point where the personality still feels in control. When it grows beyond the point where the personality does no longer feel as though it is in control of the lower self, the personality becomes both rebellious and starts to limit the self's ability to improve. And you could say, well, why would we be made that way? Well, God created everything, right? Humans included. And in its wisdom, in this particular life form, God knew we were made to eventually find God, where lower life that's not its primary existence, and it gets its meaning in a totally different way. But we get ultimately the meaning of, from finding God, because God makes it so that the personality which keeps us alive until we're 10 years old or so, or a little older, depends, is necessary to have then, and in a weird way, even necessary to keep for many long years afterwards, because it limits us from getting much meaning in life if we continue to be selfish, particularly after the age of 28. What? Yeah. Well, who cares? I mean, that sounds like some kind of strange formula of limitation. God's not supposed to limit people. God's supposed to give us freedom. Now, we are free. But we are not just a self, a lower self, and a personality. We include a soul. And we can't remain free by gaining meaning in our life if we continue to be selfish beyond the level of the percentages I gave you, because the personality becomes too threatened by our own creation of our own self. And you could say, oh, well, okay, let's say that God really invented the personality that way. How come we can't make a bargain? Hey, don't worry, personality. I'm just going to get more and more selfish, so you don't have to worry nothing, and I'll still let you control me. But the personality knows better. It can sense. It has a direct sense of its level of control. And when that level falls below a certain point, it starts to freak out. It literally becomes threatened of its own existence, and the fear of death, a very primal fear, the greatest, enters into the person. The fear of death becomes so strong that it develops either into a neurosis or a personality disorder, which tremendously limits the person from being any more successful in developing the lower self. So you get emotional, quote, mental disorders by exceeding this strange combination. And this is something I call the modernized version of esoteric psychology as it was presented beginning about 100 years ago, but it now, today, I think is presented in a new way, somewhat by people like me. Because my background is in psychology, so then obviously I can speak with a little bit of authority. All right, so here is this weird, weird thing. It's just so weird that it's almost hard to believe, isn't it? That there's really a stop sign in the development of being selfish by developing the lower self, and the stop sign is inside of us. It's not on the outside. It's also an affront to a thing called evil, but that's a whole other thing we'll talk about. But it's a very strange thing that ultimately, I said affront. It doesn't stop evil. You need to understand that. An affront just means it prevents but doesn't totally prevent it. It's an obstacle. The amazing thing about this is that almost nobody recognizes this about themselves, because the personality is your subconscious. So you don't know what that personality is thinking, except you do feel more fearful and eventually very fearful about a lot of things if you go past this ratio that I'm talking about. It varies from person to person. I'm going to explain how and why, again, in tonight's show. But the fascinating thing about this is that no matter what category you fall into in those ratios, once you hit it, it's like you're running into a brick wall. And you start becoming afraid of creation itself. Not unknowing. So you become overly cautious. Due to the ultimate fear of death, remember, the primal fear is of death, but the rationalized fear that the personality usually comes up with, suggesting to the self and the self-grabbing hold of his, oh, I don't want to lose any more money, or I don't want to take a chance with this or that. And so the progression of development of the lower self ceases. But the big deal is, since consciousness and the growing of consciousness and the continual need to grow consciousness is what gives life meaning, the meaning in life decreases and the person suffers from that, suffers. That's the main cause of suffering, is the loss of meaning in life. And this is before you ever get into any question about the soul. This is all an internal structure built into all of us, and it explains a huge amount of the psychology and some of the emotional and mental disorders, well, personality disorders, that are going on in people all the time. Some of these are almost, we'll say, the norm in some people in some places. So it's a strange thing, yet it's around us, everywhere. All right, so, and I hope I'm not going too fast, but again, you can re-listen to everything I'm saying here. The stuff I'm talking about tonight I'm sure I have not presented it in such a way that you could understand it in this way, this easily. All right, so when we're talking about ABCs, now we have probably the biggest obstacle is our conflict between our subconscious and our conscious side, as long as we remain selfish. Well, there has to be some way around this, because it sounds like it's almost a tug of war that there's no answer to. Well, there isn't. Let me tell you the answer. The answer is that the self has help from the soul and solar angel, the assisting soul, we'll call it, the oversoul, that allows it to become something greater than just a small self. The greater self it wants to grow all selves, not just the self of the person, and this breaks the hold of the personality. But it does so in a unique way. The personality simultaneously fuses, if it allows itself to, this is a big deal, it has to allow this, to, because it's always the lower that controls, not the higher. That's a strange idea in spiritual terms. But it has to allow it, and if it does, it fuses with the soul, the human soul, not the soul angel, the human soul, as much as the self fuses, but it isn't called fusion then, it's usually called joins with the higher self and soul. But the higher self is the prime joining being. And this is a very strange thing, because it's like we're going back to being what we were before we incarnate. And this can start to happen right here in the physical world. When that takes place, the stop sign goes away. There is no longer this turmoil that's going on between the personality and the lower self. A lot of the personality disorders go away, so you would expect there to be a lot of personality disorders in people who actually are moving towards being spiritual or are finding it difficult to be spiritual but are on that path, because you're already at this tug-of-war point. Some people won't even be near that, and they could be very selfish but not have a personality disorder or a neurosis. Isn't that weird? But it explains a lot if you understand more of this process on a psychological level. All right, so if the soul permits it, if the personality permits it, it will start to fuse with the soul. What is fusion, by the way? I mean, it's a whole weird thing. Well, a fusion is a process of joining with but remaining still individual. Joining with but remaining still individual in spiritual terms. In physics, it has to do with two different types of atoms coming together and joining and producing usually energy of some enormous magnitude. There is a little bit of similarity in that issue, because when you join the personality with the soul, the fusion of that makes the person greater than the sum of the two. That's because they both remain individuals and grow at least equal amounts in themselves. So you don't gain just the sum of them. You gain at least the square of them. Each is gaining by its own growth and the growth of each together. So it's a kind of unusual kind of growth, but it really isn't unusual as far as human beings are concerned, but it's unusual in terms of the mathematics. Okay, so that's the first part of the process. And if the personality gets too afraid and the person doesn't do something about it fairly early, the personality becomes obstinate, even rebellious. Rebelliousness usually depicts a personality disorder. And chooses deliberately a life pattern that will act as a block to further pushing on it to fuse with its soul, and or for the self, the lower self, to join with the higher self. Now, the reason I say the fusion part is different, it doesn't really exist with the two selves, is when the lower self joins with the higher self, unlike the personality and soul, there is no form involved on the lower self's part, and the only form that's involved on the higher self's part has to do with a thing called the atomic structure of the solar angel, which is totally different from what we would think of as atoms. And if it's for all intents and purposes formless, you don't have what would be considered any kind of fusion. You have a joining of consciousness. Now, joining of consciousness is different than the soul doing with the personality, at least as we understand it. What's really happening when they join together is they truly are joining their senses, their knowledge part, and the consciousness of the soul is only becomes part of the personality when the personality actually does some kind of creative factor. So this is where the personality doesn't gain by just having some understanding, because it never gains it directly, it gains it through itself. So that still requires that not only the personality fuse with the soul, but it has to also cooperatively share its knowledge or information with the self, which then cooperatively shares its consciousness. They have to come together and create both sides of the fence together, but they don't have a part of the other side either. So it's a very interesting connective process. I know that's all this is like, oh, well, this goes to that and this goes to that. I know. You can re-listen to this again if this is still like, woo, it's going too fast, I can't keep up with it. That's all right. You can go back over it. You don't have to really understand everything I'm saying to get through the ABCs tonight. But nonetheless, explaining this is a major part of the beginning of tonight's show. And we're about done with that major part, at least for right now. And so I'm going to let your brains cool down. And think about during the commercial, if you want, you can listen to that too if you want, some of the interesting elements of what I just spoke about, because there's a lot there, isn't there, in getting to the ABCs part, and we can start seeing how this maybe explains things that you didn't understand before as well. So we're going to come back in about 2.5 minutes and resume our ABCs of creating virtue.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. M-A-C-F-L-O-U-E-R.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about the ABCs of creating virtue. Yes. And I hope you heard the first part of the show, because there I defined a lot of the things that we'll go into more practical sides on, as well as some interesting, we'll call it esoteric psychological ideas. Esoteric just means hidden from most elements of that particular science, which is psychology. Now, I want to, again, urge people to re-listen to the first part of the show, because it was a lot to cover in a short time, and I didn't want to spend most of the rest of the show going over some of those things. But it's important sort of as a foundation, and at the same time, the worst of already practical ideas coming out. I think the first thing that strikes me as a practical idea is this. If you want to have more meaning in life, and I would say most people do, you need to be willing to face fears that come somewhat irrationally, by the way, by the selfish creation of the lower self. And part of that is an indication, by the way, that you have reached that limit. So if you find, as an example, that you have actually a lot of, we'll say, reservations, concerns, doubts, as you try to create anything, whatever it might be, or co-create with someone else, or whatever, that is an indication in and of itself that you are bumping up against those stop signs that I referred to. And it's also an indication that your life is becoming less meaningful, and you're certainly not growing in a soul consciousness way. Yeah, so those are all indications of that. And you can look at that if you do a self-appraisal. And this is going to be what I suggest. No matter what your level of consciousness is, this is a general principle. When you start having these excessive fears or some other kinds of behaviors, I'll try to describe them to you, that fall more into the ordered disordered personality realm. And that includes the following. besides excessive fears, which would be mostly a neurotic kind of, we'll call it esoteric or spiritual neuroses, then there's the more spiritual personality disorder, again, somewhat different than open or well-known psychological personality disorders, and may be more common, although they can certainly coincide and exist simultaneously with the psychological ones. Now, what would those be? Well, when the personality is threatened and feels as though it is losing control, and this can start in childhood, by the way, with the wrong kind of parenting and even abuse in parenting or even by other, we'll say, environmental abuses during childhood. The result can be the following, that the personality not only feels out of control, okay, but it seeks to be in control by misusing the lower self to excessively manipulate and control others. Excessively manipulate and control others for the sake of it just being in control. That's the definition esoterically of this kind of general class of personality disorders, but it also fits the normal psychological part, in part, definition of personality disorders. It also means that the person generally, in a self sense, feels inadequate. Why do they feel inadequate? Well, because the adequacy would come from them having a general sense of being in control without having to spend a good deal of their time and energy trying to manipulate others. And many times, the manipulation turns sour and could become hostile towards the self of others. Now, if you're hostile towards the self of others, then you have a characterological disorder in psychology terms, but it also fits spiritually. And the results can be things like sociopathology. Oh, that's a bad word. And it could even lead to psychopathology, which is not only the destruction of other people's cells, but maybe of their physical existence in some way, if not their life itself. And it also means that instead of trying to just destroy the self, the person wants to gain absolute control over the self of the other person, which also could lead to murderous or, we'll say, severe kinds of torturous means. I don't know if that's a psychopath. Now, a sociopath seeks to control the self of others, but they seek it for an increased level of control in themselves through feeling that they can control other people, but only at the diminishment of the self of others, not the diminishment of their actual total beingness. Okay? So those are the differences between those two words, but there's a lot of other kinds of personality disorders that don't fall into that category. Personality disorders in general fall into the category of just, we'll say, attempting to get something for nothing, from others, at usually their cost, and the getting something for nothing gives the personality a sense of, or a replacement of, love. So the personality, once it becomes unusually controlling, tries to get the self, instead of wanting to develop things that are giving, to develop only things, or mostly things that are taking. And when it does that, it feels love in itself, as though it loves itself, by getting something from others for nothing. And so the normal exchange of the little self is in a person is to give something to get something. In a personality disordered person, it's just to get something without giving. Okay? And in a soul-developed person, the little self, as it joins with the higher self, seeks to give something for nothing that it gains. Are you following that? And when it does that, that allows it to co-create with God and to feel as though God loves it and it loves God. And so you lose that when you are personality disordered, and especially in the spiritual terminology that I'm using. But this would be true even psychologically. And you also lose the ability to become more of your soul while you're physically alive here or wherever you might be living if you have these kinds of problems. Now, what about the neurosis side? The neurosis side means that the person becomes overly involved with their astral nature and is seeking a feeling of a feeling good regardless of the cost to others and regardless of the diminishment of one's own self. So the personality disorder, the personality, when neurotic, because the self is diminishing, feels a sense of loss of itself. And that makes it terrified and fearful, and it lives in a state of fear of death, and a desire to just feel better, sometimes regardless of the cost of the self its own self, just as long as it feels better. So it's a very strange condition, but fairly common to develop, if especially in a person who strangely is more developed in a, let's say, lower self sense than a person who isn't, because there's less struggle with a person with a lower development of self between the subconscious part of them and the conscious part of them. So in the ABC part of this, you need to make an evaluation of where you fall in that spectrum and whether you're actually doing some of the things that I'm talking about, because there are answers for these things, which I'm going to give you in tonight's show. But you need to define who you are. And you can do this somewhat by asking others to evaluate you in terms of the show. You can have them listen to the show and say, would you do me a favor? And since you take in what this fellow's saying and evaluate me on this basis and tell me where I am about this, if I can't figure it out for myself, because maybe I'm already too contaminated with the subconscious part who's not going to allow me to really be objective. So you can ask for the assistance of others. This is the reason for spiritual groups, by the way, because this is what a group can do for you. But if you don't have a spiritual group, or you're not a member of one, or you don't want to become part of one, you can just try to do this with someone that you can trust to some level. And it may be a valuable part of getting to the truth about yourself. Also, you can do it by a couple forms of meditation. You can reflect on it yourself by being detached and looking at yourself as being, and your personality, but in your subconscious part, as being separate from you in your reflection. And then you can contemplate on the answers from that to see how far it goes. The contemplation will tell you how bad it is, and the reflection will tell you what it is to begin with. So the contemplation will give you more of a quantitative answer, whereas the reflective side will give you some factual understandings of who you might be. This is not easy. It can take literally months to come up with good answers, including getting assistance from other people, because after all, they're not always available, right? So it's a process, but it can be very effective. If you know someone who is a spiritual person, maybe they can help you with it better than someone who isn't. Because this is a real in-depth examination of who each of us is. Okay, so that's a good place to begin in trying to get to and understand this interesting element about us. Now, why would you want to know this stuff? Well, if you don't have a basis that you can both somewhat clearly understand about yourself and somewhat clearly understand in a quantitative way using some kind of percentage about your consciousness, because that's what we're really trying to get to, then you won't be able to make adequate changes. You need the foundation, the basis of where you're starting from, so you can see objectively if you're improving or going, that just makes sense. All right, so again, how do you determine the bottom line of consciousness? Well, as I said earlier in the show, most people are between 1% and 2%. The way you know it is by the following examples in measurement in time and space. How much time are you spending per hour? And just think about each hour. I've given this exercise to many people over the course of my teaching. How much time have you spent in thinking solely of others and trying to, in some way, help them to enlighten whatever they're doing in their life? Help them to become more a soul themselves. That's your measure of soul consciousness in comparison to the next question, how much time did I spend on increasing my little self in the next hour, in that hour? Now, if the combination of these two is less than a third of the entire hour at a minimum, about a third is the minimum, that you, and this is assuming you're awake, okay, not, don't count when you're sleeping. If you haven't reached at least a third of that hour, where you're doing either one of those two, then you have most likely either a neurosis or a personality disorder. Theoretically, you could also have a psychosis, in which case your consciousness overall is, yourself is overall so diminished that you can't connect with the world around you. But that's a whole other thing, and that's a class of people that I don't think we need to be discussing tonight. Okay. So, looking at it from that standpoint, if you're down below a third, there's a good, very good chance you have either a neurosis, a personality disorder, in a spiritual sense, for both, or both of those things going on with you at the same time. And your feeling and thinking, your thoughts, should complement the feeling that there's a lack of meaning in your life. Now, why do I say a third? What is so big about that? Well, it has to do with the way the structure of the two being parts of us, personality and the self, has developed in the whole human race on an average and in the more developed parts of the planet, not the most primitive people, because we're not dealing with them. So most people have gone beyond that level of consciousness, that would be about a bottom line to discovering where we're at. Now you could say, well, what is that bottom line then? Where are we talking about? Well, I'm not talking about consciousness in a purely a pure state. I'm talking about consciousness where I'm including all elements of being able to say you understood something that was going on around you. Because I'm going to get to the consciousness of just literally the creation element, and that's a totally different thing. So the consciousness of a person, if it's less than a third of the time that they are physically awake, and that includes not creating anything, not doing a darn thing to create, then that indicates an emotional and or mental health problem. Okay, but let's say that you're beyond that. Okay, all right, I at least I used to be conscious enough to know where I was and what I was doing and blank, blank, blank. Well, then that's good. Now we get to the creative consciousness, which is what I spoke about earlier in the show. The creative consciousness, if you recall, is what the soul level of consciousness is added with the lower self level of consciousness is. The lower self, in many people, doesn't exceed about 16% or so if they have, give or take, a less than 2% soul consciousness. So that would be 18%, right? That's if we take the average person. The average person is no more than about 18% creatively conscious, which means that they are doing something to alter their environment that brings meaning into their life. Now, that's a little bit more than a third, if you think about it. Slightly more, I mean, than half of a third. So it's slightly more than half of a third. It's close to 60%. That's a magic number. Because it's the 60% that's a critical element here. If you are 60% level creative consciousness, you develop some level of what is called mundane memory. Mundane memory lasts in time and space for some part, if not all, of that particular world of consciousness lifetime. And possibly beyond that world through the whole time that a person is incarnated until they go back to being their soul. So that's the amount that we can say we remember of our life. Well, that means that the average person remembers up to or less than 18% of their life. And that's correct. That's all you remember. That means that 82% of a lot of people, not everybody, but 82%, majority of people, I shouldn't say most, but the majority of people only remember 18% and they don't remember 82% of their life. It's kind of a shocker. All right, so this becomes, and it's all relative, too. It gets into a strange relative issue. So what about the rest of the time? Like I said, up to a third, that you're conscious. You're at least, there's some consciousness, but memory isn't taking place. Well, at the moment, that means while you're conscious, you can interact with your environment or not, without making a huge error or without being so lacking in consciousness that you would cause a great mistake, some level, significant level of mistake. But it doesn't mean you're going to remember that part. It doesn't mean that at all. So you can be conscious and not have memory. To have memory, you have to have a 60% level of creative consciousness. And for most people, that's a significant level, you see. Okay, so what about the people who fall below the 2% and the 16%? And they don't have even that, right? Well, then it just diminishes. Their level of memory continues to fall, and it could fall to 10%. Or 9 or 8 or 7. Wow. Now, the proof of this is to try to remember, and you can do this in your own analysis, and I suggest you do this, is to try to remember how much you do remember. Try to see each day. That's another way to determine how much you're creative in consciousness or not. It doesn't mean whether you were conscious at the moment, because that could be double what we're talking about. But it does mean that you won't retain that it ever happened. And when you don't retain that things happen, you have a lost meaning to your life. So meaning comes from not just being conscious, it comes from being creatively conscious. You have to be creating something, or you won't remember. And it needs to be 60% of the time that you were conscious, period. At least. Or you're going to have trouble remembering. All right, that gets scary. So what happens to people who fall right in the edge of the suffering? Well, yeah, that gets kind of goofy because you do end up with people having just terrible memories, literally. And they can't remember what they did last week, last month, and further you go out in time, less they have the memory of what they were doing ever. When you live your life like that, you have a very tenuous meaning in it and a lack of ability to sense yourself, which could lead you into these neuroses issues or the personality disorder issues, which is why I said there's an interconnectivity between all these numbers and the things I'm explaining about. Okay, so when you don't have 60% of your memory, you not only don't have enough memory in this lifetime, but you don't have enough in any lifetime. And you only remember beyond this lifetime, which means before you go back to being yourself, beyond it, if you 60% create memory that is enlightened, because that's the only part of memory that becomes part of your soul. So if you're only creating with your little self and your personality, and your soul and higher self are not involved, that none of that life is remembered. None. And that's considered a lost life. All right, so this is a big deal, right? I mean, we're talking about things that make some significant difference to all of us. Now, okay, how do you increase all this stuff? Well, you start evaluating. You've got to know where you're at to be able to know where you want to go to, right? So first thing is to figure this whole thing out. I mean, I've given you an awful lot of ways of determining this. That's why I'm using all these different numbers and stuff. What happens if somebody who is creating only at 1% and maybe only 1% in 8%. That's a pretty low number. Usually those people have either a neurosis or personality disorder at some level. They also have very bad memories. And they don't remember much about their life. And what they don't remember, they do a thing called confabulation. What's that? They make up what they can't remember. They fill in a lot of blanks. And your life becomes a wished life rather than a real life. And the meaning they have in life is based upon fantasies and reality. Not a good thing. And none of that will be creating virtues, so they won't. It's like they didn't live physically. When they get to the astral world, some of it gets ironed out and people raising consciousness, so these numbers shift around some, and that's a good thing. But I'm talking about physical life right now, and that's what today's show is going to be focused on. So you need to make an assessment, and you can use some of the ways I've already suggested. All right, so let's say that you come out and you're at 1.5%, or 1.6 or whatever, and you're somewhere around 16, 15, 16%, which means that you really push the limits. Before and you're also starting to develop neuroses, which is excessive fears. Or, and I'm talking about spiritual neuroses. This is a little bit different than the pure psychological analysis. Or you're starting to develop some over-controlling nature where you're actually trying to diminish the self of others, which is a very negative, dark thing, which would be a personality disorder. So you've got either one or both of those going on. And you can see it in yourself. What do you need to do? Well, the first thing is to recognize the problem, because that could be able to change it. You don't recognize it. Then you've got to cease doing the more negative behaviors, which include reacting to the fear, which is usually the primal fear of death, although it may be hidden by 100 other fears or 1,000 other fears. Oh, I'm not going to have enough money. I'm not going to have this. You've got to fight it. And how do you fight it? Well, you use will, which is the consistency of seeing choices, but you have to create more virtue while you're doing it. You've got to do something that helps you to understand God more and or helps you to co-create with God more. And you need to use some of the same feelings of fears, some of the same energy from those feelings, to do the creation of light. So you need to actually take the fear, and in spite of it, and despite it, change it into the joy of creation, make that fear into something that becomes exhilarating and meaningful to you and for others, and then gain the joy of helping to create consciousness in others instead of in yourself. That's the best way to solve the problem. Oh, yeah, you could go into psychotherapy and just deal with your little self, but it tends to, in some people, make them more neurotic because it doesn't, if they're at the crossroads where they have gone as far as they can in creating themselves, they've got a problem. It's easier for people who are less developed to go into psychotherapy because they don't have the stop sign yet, and they're just the little minor bumps, and they can maybe get over some of them and feel better. Very difficult for someone to go into psychotherapy who's basically maybe even led a spiritual life before and is choosing not to in this life and has developed the neurosis of personality, so spiritually speaking. And so those folks have psychotherapy may not be a good answer for them because it's not the right venue for the nature of the problem. Now, spiritual psychotherapy, which is a whole rare thing, with someone who has an understanding about this stuff, which is as I'm explaining it, yeah, well, that would be great. And if you could find someone like that, that would be helpful. Yeah. Actually, most teachers who are in the area of metaphysics and spirituality would be better to help because they understand the nature of the problem, even if they're not the world's greatest psychotherapist. If you could find both, that's even better. All right, so here is the way it works. You've got to take that same energy. That's part of the glamour, or desire that you have for either more love or to be more in control and or to diminish other selves. You got to take that same energy and create something that helps others to become more conscious. And you'll get over it quickly. Date. You can't just will it away. You have to use will in your choices, but those wills and choices have to be about using the same energy. You can't just will it away because, well, I'm going to wish for it, think, and I'll change it. I've got the will, baby. I got the will. Because when you try to will away a fixed desire, it will fool you into thinking that you're doing it for other people when you're really still focused with the motive of doing it for yourself. And that doesn't get you out of the problem. It may make it worse. So motive becomes a vague but very important issue. And if your motive isn't truly to serve others, to help others to be more conscious and or more creative of life, then the whole thing falls apart. I hope you're following me. And it varies from person to person. People who are not very well developed in their lower self, they may have lived half or a third, a quarter of the lifetimes others have lived. They've still got a way to grow. They don't have to do as much. They really don't. They can have a very meaningful life. You can see the stop sign is way ahead of them. So they could develop part of their lower self. They can do a little bit of growing in their higher self, a little bit of doing some things to help others to be more conscious or and or to become more creative with and for God. They can do that a little bit and have a great, meaningful life. If you're well past that in your development, and a lot of people listening to the show actually are, then you have a greater concern with things I'm talking about tonight. And you're going to have a more difficult time. It's going to take more doing the right things and a greater level of will, greater and sacrifice as well. And so it's going to be maybe a more arduous spiritual task. Not unrewarding. The reward is as great as the problem is to resolve. So you will, the reward is commensurate with that. But the reward is joy and eventually bliss, as well as true meaning, real meaning. Enormous amounts of meaning in the life you are in now. And a memory of that life in your next, all your future life, if it's virtuous. Wow. That's a big deal. Those are good pills, if you ask me. All right. So looking at this whole thing, I would say, hey, this doesn't sound impossible, but it's difficult for some people. It becomes progressively more difficult the greater the level of neurosis in spiritual terms, neurosis and personality disorder, and the less the person has attempted to change it up to this point, the greater the difficulty. Now, let's talk about some of the magic ways that you can use as tools to get the wrong line here. The first and the most important is a thing called humility. What is humility? Humility comes from three models, physical, emotional, and mental. And in the physical sense, well, let's start with the mental sense. In the mental sense, and I mean it sense-wise, you need to challenge your senses whenever conflicted by mental information coming from any other source, especially another human being, but any other source, and compromise in the sense that you give up your conclusions of your lower self and your personal interest, personal subconscious self, for the benefit of accepting the correctness and accuracy of other thoughts, different from your own. Why? Because it's the way you grow and the way you help others to grow at the same time. By not arguing against and or being silent in admission of errors or ideas, you're open-minded. You leave the idea in your head. The truth is that you accept that the other person, other idea, other thought, your reading, whatever it is accurate and correct more so than your own. And certainly, if it turns out to be, then the second part of humility, which is to, we'll say, negatively assert that you know you made the mistake, that the other person or thought or whatever you read was correct, and give credit, even if it's only, if you can't communicate with the other person directly at that moment, give credit to them anyway, and whenever possible, give credit to others on the other person's behalf. So if you meet an author and you say, this guy was right, I was wrong, let everybody else know about that author. If you know a person but they're not available at the time, you let others know about that person being right about it. And if the person is available, you let them immediately know that they are right and you accept that. Now you say, well, what if they're wrong? Well, if they're wrong, you'll say, for right now, I accept you're right, or I'm going to accept it, and I'm going to ask you some more questions, or I'm going to look deeper and get more information, because I'm still confused at how you're right. But for right now, I'm going to accept that you're right. I'm going to make that my assumption. If you find out they are right, you do all the things I said. You tell others, you accept it, you thoroughly renounce yourself while you give accolades and feedback to the person who helped you to find truth in your mind. On the astral side, you do not desire, you give up the desire to be right. If you can't give up the desire to be right, even if you mentally do the exercise, you will increase a thing called the kama-manasa connection. So the next time, you'll be even more difficult to be humble, even though you were humble mentally. You weren't humble astrally, and you increase the kama-manasa connection. So So the next time you won't be better at it, you'll be worse at it. Until finally you won't do it anymore. So you have to deal with the desire or glamour to be right every time. Now, how do you deal with the desire? Well, do everything I said in the first part, but add another element to it. You've got to use the energy to be right to diminish that energy by giving to the other person a sense of self-worth and make them get the understanding of their own truth and their own rightness. Make them more while you don't take any credit in yourself, including the credit to help them be more. That all goes. And if you use the same energy that you had to desire to be right, you now become more loving, vastly more loving. So you're either going to be more loving or you're going to be more selfish and try to obscure your wrongness, so to speak, and desire still because you still desire to be right. So one way of looking at this is either you're going to quote-unquote get your feeling of being right or get your feeling of being more loving. By being more loving, you actually experience the love inside yourself and you feel more love as you give more love. When you do the reverse, you feel less loved, more hollow, more empty, more lonely, more dejected. And so you have, gee, I was right at the cost of I. I goes away, but you're more right. Okay, well, that's terrific. So you feel less of a self in the process of having to feel right. And you definitely feel less loved by yourself and by others because you can't accept being loved by others when you are holding on to this need to be right, which is the antithesis or opposite of humility. So humility has those two, and then there's a third part of humility in the physical sense. Humility means that you must also take some action. The action can be verbal, which would be speaking. The action can be sometimes written. The action can be physically doing something for and with the other person along their thought line. So someone says, well, if we do this together, we can get this done, and you agree to do it, then you're doing the physical part of it. If you think it's right, and you even react by denouncing or renouncing or both your desire to feel like you're right, but you still don't take the activity with the person, you have not completed the humility. There's still pieces of both the mental and astral part you haven't dealt with. And that's a dead giveaway. So let's say that, you're right, that's a good thing, and then you even tell yourself that, well, I'll try to let them know and that they're right and feel that it's right, but then it requires some action on your part to contribute in some way. Maybe you have to go get something for the person. Maybe you have to, in order to help them in their idea. Maybe you need to do something you're going to do, and then you choose not to do it. Those are all things that show you're really not humble. Or you say, well, XYZ was going to do it for you. That person will do it for you. Those people will do it for you. This group will help you, but not me. Same thing, no humility. Humility goes out the window when you controvert your ideas and your feelings with a lack of action that's appropriate for the situation. How many times have you agreed with somebody in a mental sense? How many times have you creatively even responded with them mentally? And how many times have you felt a lack of need to be right But then when it comes time to actually give him a physical sense, oh, here's the name of somebody else that can do it for you, not me. Or just not even give it to them, but give somebody else a name. Here, call this person. And you bow out. You don't complete. That's a non-humble person who ultimately is hiding, trying to hide, through their own selfishness. And they also usually have had some spiritual training, so they're trying to fool other people. Showing up is the bottom line. You don't show up, you can't be humble, and you can't be servant. We're going to get to service, that's the next step. But first thing was humility. So you can't be humble, much less serving, if you don't show up. All right, that's the physical side. Now let's go to service, the next thing. Besides being humble, you want to be of service to others. Now, you have to be humble to be of service, so be aware of that. So let's say you're humble, but there's another step to humility. Service means that you are actively creating a way for the other person to be more soul-like, for the other person to be more serving themselves. Okay, you have to be actively doing that. It's a little bit different than humility, which is a bit more on the passive side, except when you get to the third part, the physical, there's more action, but still near what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about, when you really get to service, the rule is this. Service means that you receive zero, nothing, for your lower self. Humility, you may still receive something for your lower self. That wasn't a requirement. It's better if you don't. But with service, spiritual service, it means nothing. You get zero, either mentally, astrally, in your own desires, or physically. That's the hardest part probably for a lot of people. So you get nothing. You put out all this time, energy, and everything else, and the other person may dump on you for it. You know, they may not be cooperative, or they may grow in some way. Now, if they dump on you, you don't continue to serve people that dump on you, but you restrict, or you may not dump back on them, and you may not, hopefully you won't, and you may not completely desert them, depends on the circumstances. But you certainly don't continue to give in ways that makes people more selfish. You restrict that giving. They may feel as though you're angry at them, or selfish, or mean, or whatever. And that's their own illusion coming into play. It's not you doing that. It's them doing it to themselves. They may fear you. They may think you're going to do something terrible to them. It's not true. But they conclude that based upon what? Well, they conclude it based upon their desires, their need to be in control, all the other stuff we talk about in this show. So you can see this is, there's two sides of the equation. If you're going to be of service, it's a huge jump. Humility is the first step. There's no question about it. You can't be a soul if you're not humble. But to be more a soul, at least some of the time, you have to be of service. Now, here's the clue to being of service. Remember when we talked about the business of the soul and the percentage that you're conscious, as a soul? When you're being of service, that level of consciousness is always increasing. Always increasing by definition. So not only does nothing come back to you on a selfish level for yourself, but you always are becoming more conscious, always, while you're serving. It may be fractional, like if you lift your consciousness, is it 1.6% soul? Well, maybe it's going up a thousandth of that every hour that you're in serving. It doesn't sound like much, but it's over time, in 1,000 hours or 1,600 hours of service, you have doubled your consciousness. That's so small amount in terms of your soul consciousness, not personal. Also be aware that personal consciousness can drop while you're increasing soul consciousness. Now, how does that happen? Well, if you're really not focused much on the development of your lower self, there is some cost sometimes that the lower self loses some of the skills and abilities, even knowledge, even memories in a personal sense, that it had because so much is being devoted to its service and humility. The drop is usually not that great, but it can be as much as half. So if, let's say you're at 16 and 1.6, that's a huge spread right there, that's a lot. It's a tenfold, pretty much getting to the limits of the whole thing, right? Even eight times is huge, but 10, it's a huge amount. You haven't yet, but you're on the verge of developing the neurosis of personality disorder. It is possible to drop the personal side of the little self consciousness down to half and grow the soul up double to like 3.2% while the consciousness briefly falls to 8. But that may happen only for in a few weeks or months, and within a brief period of time, the two will start raising again, but more in unison. And eventually the soul will go up and down, with the personality going down while the soul goes up. Eventually it goes back and forth until the two are equal. And that's an important point, right? When you reach inequality between personal self, lower self development, and soul development, it means that there's inequality between the solar angel, the higher self, and the lower self. At that point, because that involves consciousness so intensely, consciousness starts taking a very strong curve upwards, because without doing more and more service, you actually gain more and more consciousness. That doesn't mean you won't keep serving. It just means that there's a big bump. So reaching that point where your soul consciousness equals your personal consciousness is a huge biggie. That's a big point to reach. Now, just because you reach that point, you then have to become more creative. And this is the tough thing that most people don't get. Why do you have to become more creative? Because remember, the creative side, it involves still using the senses and information, etc., the form. And you can't rely just on understanding. You have to now co-create with God. The creative side involves getting your hands dirty and actually doing things that may cause a loss of consciousness and making mistakes. If you're afraid of making mistakes, when your personal consciousness reaches the level of your soul consciousness, you will stop developing. I'm going to say that one more time. When your soul consciousness approximates your personal consciousness, and if you're afraid of making mistakes, usually because you don't want to, what? You don't want to look bad. In a spiritual sense, maybe, but you don't want to look bad. And you're more concerned about that, oftentimes, is the problem. There are other reasons, but that's the biggest. But regardless of what the reason is, you stop developing. You need to make the change, the shift, at that point, to being more creative. And people have spent lifetimes stuck. Believe it or not, it has been for more than one lifetime, for sure. People have caught themselves in that serious dilemma. And it can be at a fairly high level. You can be at 25% of each and yet not virtually move. What's the answer? No focus on yourself in terms of whether or not you are making a mistake, and be willing to take on more and more creative factors in service. It can't be just creation through humility itself, but certainly humility plays a major part in it, because people who don't want to look bad are not really humble. And in addition to that, you've got to be willing to make mistakes, because you can't create without making mistakes, because you're pushing on the limits of your ability to respond. It's not that you don't want to be of service, it's that you reach the limits of how much you can, and you're still going to make some mistakes. Mistakes are, by definition, selfish, but they are at a level of selfishness that is so hidden that almost nobody can get around it. almost nobody can live life without making mistakes. We're prone to be selfish up until the very last lifetime that we exist as a human being. It's a state of beingness for humans. So hard for us to see that. And people who can't stand making mistakes are prone to this problem. And they usually get stuck somewhere along the line where their personal consciousness equals their soul consciousness, and both can be fairly high. They stop growing. And that's bad news. Can you get around it? Absolutely. But you've got to be willing to do what I'm saying. All right. So these are the quirky natures of things, and they actually happen on a regular basis. I could speak from the teaching side of things that this is a common element. And in terms of people who say they're on the spiritual path, it's rare that someone makes it all the way down that path without ever having a lifetime or two where this becomes an issue. So I assume some of you who are listening to me tonight, it's an issue for you. All right, so you have to push on your humility because that will break through this issue of wanting to look good, and you need, if that is the issue for you, and you need, in either case, to increase your creative side when you balance the two, the consciousness with a personal interest and the consciousness of soul interest within yourself, then you definitely have to push to be much more creative in spiritual service. And creative doesn't mean just doing what the things are you think you're supposed to be on. It means taking on and creating absolutely the more threatening elements. Well, you're going to definitely make more mistakes. Absolutely positive. Okay. Interesting, huh? Didn't know there was so much to the subject of that. All right. So we are now looking at these unusual factors that do play pretty much in most people's spiritual development. Now, what if you're not at that stage? Let's say that you're listening to tonight's show. Maybe the first time you're listening, you say, well, you know, I don't think I'm even near that. Okay, that's all right. Still, developing humility, even before you develop spiritual service, is a big deal in your lifetime. The most humble person will gain more than the most attempting spiritual person if they're not humble. Remember, humility is like number one. Constant states of being humble are absolutely critical. Don't be careful about pseudo-humility. What is pseudo-humility? Where you make it look like you're humble, but you're really not. Remember, you've got to have the three elements. And if any one of the three are missing, you're not humble. I don't care how good you are at the other two or one. It makes no difference. Got to have the three. There's also a level of balancing the three where the quality of the humility goes up. The better balanced they are, the higher the quality of humility. Now, what do I mean by quality? I mean humility becomes more effective in helping others to be humble and to serve if the three parts, the mental, astral, and physical, are balanced with each other in degree and execution of each. And that's a big deal. If you notice that your humility doesn't seem to be, in general, helping the people around you, then you have to concern yourself with the balance factor. Now, there are exceptions to what I'm telling you. Some people could be, humility is all, humble is all get out, but they're around people who generally are so much the antithesis of that, it wouldn't matter how much they're balanced, the other people are going to respond with humility. Well, that's a matter of opportunity and or karma and or maybe if you're very advanced, the lot of life that you have chosen for yourself for a particular lifetime as a test of various reasons, which we don't need to go into tonight. So here is where you can see that there's a practical side to this whole thing. Balance means that you are as good and doing as well in your humility in the mental part as you are in the execution in your physical side, or either of those two in terms of your desire to be right yourself. So all of those, and to therefore not be loving, all of those things come together And if you can balance them, you will get the best results in terms of others, which is really what it's all about. That's what souls want, and that's what souls do. You become your more your soul faster by achieving that particular quality. Okay. Let's talk about the creation of virtue in some other practical ways. When people who are on the spiritual path are creating virtue, they need to, at a much higher level of enlightenment of the form, both inside themselves and that of those that they're co-participating with and that of the surrounding world that they exist in. Now, what do I mean by much more? Well, you compare the level that you're capable of creating light in form and how much you're actually doing it. Your capabilities has to do with your overall condition of your senses. Creation comes from the form side, remember that. So you've got to have this, we'll say, innate development of your senses to a level that will equal the level that you are going to be creative at. There are times when people actually have a greater, we'll call it desire, because usually it isn't, unfortunately, affected by glamours, to create more virtue than they're capable of in terms of their senses in each of the three bodies that are relevant. And so when that takes place, it's usually because they want to do more spiritually than they can. Many times they're not yet spiritually disciplining themselves, they're more like wanting to do that sort of thing. They're aspirants to do stuff. But they may not actually be doing much spiritual discipline, and that's the biggest failing, is the lack of spiritual discipline for folks who are in that category. On the reverse side, some people have a very good spiritual development of their senses. Senses work really well, and they have good information coming in, and lots of knowledge has been created. But they have either a will problem, in which case they're not willing to sacrifice enough to create, or a fear problem, in which case the personality is somewhat in struggle, the lower self, as we talked about at the beginning of the show, or they may have an issue in which they compromise. They think it's good enough because they have some fear, but they also may have what we call spiritual laziness of sorts, to create half the level, or two-thirds of the level, or three-quarters of the level, of their sense. Even though it's way more than anybody else around them, but that's as far as they're going to go, because they can get away with it, nobody notices, it looks like they're still doing good things, and other people are responding, but they're not going up to their full capacity. What does that do when you go down that particular road? Well, you'll have to check this out yourself, because that's the reason I'm bringing it up. But if this is a condition you do have, then listen. The outcome of such a life is that you create karma, negative karma, that becomes lost opportunity. You have then lessened the likelihood that your senses will be that good in your next lifetime. You will be born with less sense than you have even developed in this lifetime, much less than you were even born with. So you will have, you could end up with less than you were born with, and even though you develop more, much more in this lifetime, through spiritual disciplines, when you don't use it at that level to create virtue, okay, your next life ends up being diminished in sense, maybe below and likely below the level you were even born at. Yeah. So that's the karmic implication, even though you create virtue. You say, what's so fair about that? Oh. You know, it doesn't work in a compensatory manner. You don't use half of your ability. which may be five times more than everybody else you know, to create virtue and get a prize for it. You get a kick in the rump because it's wrong. And you should know it's wrong. If more than anybody, you should know it's wrong. You see. And therefore, you pay more dearly for it karmically than someone who hasn't developed themselves. Even though you both may develop, create the same amount of virtue, the person who does it at their capability of doing so, meaning they're responsive or responsible, they have no negative karma from it, and you may have a hell of a lot, or vice versa, in your lives. And yet, you both did the same thing as far as it appears on the surface. Wow. This gets into motive. You can see that there's a motive factor. One person is motivated to create the highest level possible, which is called nobility, and the other one is ignoble. They think they're creating virtue, but just at less, well, less than they could do, but who cares? But it's ignoble because when you do that, you are actually creating an obstacle for others because you have to be an example, not just create virtue. You have to be an example of creating virtue, and that is lacking. You're showing other people, even though you think you're hiding it, oh, gee, look at me. I have all those capabilities, but I'm only doing half. And then they say, okay, I'll do the same thing, buddy. And so you're hurting everybody in the process. And the results of that are very negative. Maybe more negative than what you're creating in virtue in the long run. Wow. I know it sounds a little counterintuitive and unfair, but it's not. When you look at the big picture, it's completely justified the way it works. It's completely fair. It just seems unfair to the person who's doing it. Right? All right. So if you develop yourself in it using spiritual discipline, it becomes a great onus to be noble. Because if you don't, you are ignoble, meaning you're reducing nobility not only in yourself but in others. And in doing so, you're hurting them, that probably worse than if you didn't do any spiritual service at all. Probably. I mean, there's exceptions to this. It's very complicated. But you can get the general gist of what I'm trying to explain, I hope. So whatever you do, don't do that. Now, it's tough because a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to improve their senses, and they do it. They do it maybe not for spiritual reasons. That's a whole other can of worms, though. But if you are doing for spiritual reasons, you need to be noble, which means you must do the very best you can in the creation of virtue rather than do a half-assed job. Now, okay, you say, well, let's be practical. What if I do 90%? How much karma do I have if I only do with the 10%? I know. I've heard this. I actually have had that statement, that exact statement said to me by a few various people that I've acted as a teacher with. The answer here is that, look it. Okay, so you want to negotiate how much bad karma you're going to get from being selfish when you're far more capable of not being? Well, if you want to make that kind of negotiation, go ahead. I'm not sure what that leads you to. And I'm not sure if you have 10% versus 50% or whatever the story might be, what's the ultimate outcome? Because that's such a complicated thing to decide. It's really on a it's on a per soul person basis. It's far too complicated to make any general statements about it. And I've been trying to make general statements because I'm trying to include everybody in tonight's show. Now let's go the exact opposite direction. Let's say that you're just getting used to this idea that maybe you could live a little bit for other people and try to be a soul. And maybe you're willing to do something of the nature of spiritual discipline. But look, you're not going to be giving any grand amounts of material wealth or any significant amounts of anything to anybody. And maybe you don't want to give up your favorite booze or smoking a joint or doing whatever it is you do. And you say, well, I do want to create a little more virtue, but can I kind of get on board with starting somewhere? The answer to that is yes, because there is a time factor. You can make a plan 2 years, 3 years, probably up to about seven, where you assume you're going to be still alive, and you make the effort each day to make a little bit of an improvement. And you serve a little bit more each day, in a spiritual sense, but still less than your capabilities are up to this year of time that you agree you're going to be at the full level. Then you can actually negotiate the situation. And that's a fair thing to do, by the way. It's actually permitted in spiritual, we'll say, discipline, in spiritual thought. Because it is recognized that people don't change overnight. Otherwise, too much would be expected of too few, and the results would be disastrous. So that is permissible. What is not permissible is to say, I'm going to change a little and have used most of my sense for purely selfish reasons, and I know it's wrong, and I'm not going to, I don't intend on making any changes for the rest of my life. This is where I'm going to be, because I want to gain a few brownie points before I get into the astral world. That just doesn't work. Yes, you will be born with diminished sense in your next life. Yes, you will have all the problems I've talked about. And no, there's no getting around that. It's going to probably come in some way. I don't know exactly when. It could happen in this life when you go to the afterworld, too. Or it could happen later in the physical life. So be aware that there are some principles. And if you don't follow the principles, it's likely you're going to have some big headaches and problems. Now, then I hear from people, okay, well, then you're telling me I shouldn't go down the spiritual path at all because I have pretty good senses and pretty good capabilities, but I don't want to get into negative stuff, and I'm not willing to go this far and that far, so there. Well, then you should have listened to the show because now you got it. You see, once you have some level of understanding, you can't close your eyes to it. That's your problem. Why didn't I have a disclaimer? I don't know. Maybe I'm just a mean guy or something. Look, if you're really into that headspace and you've listened this far into the show or maybe read something online or someone else about the same subject, because there's a lot of commonality between what I'm teaching and a lot of other people in this field, anyway, angel's wisdom or spirituality. If you're in that ballpark and you're having that issue, well, hey, you know, maybe the thing you do need is a clobber on the head, and maybe sooner than later. So if you're going to go down that path, I have done your thing. It will accelerate your karma, actually, to even understand it and not do something about it. And you could say, well, I want to slow it down. Well, then you could become a lot more selfish, even become evil. That will certainly slow your karma down. Make it a lot worse, huge amount worse, but it will slow it down. Okay, so, yeah, I no apologies for me, from the folks who are in that ballpark. Best thing for you is probably to experience some discomfort. If you really believe that's where you're at. And I meet people like this. I'm not kidding. I meet them all the time. It's a huge mistake for them to go down that path, but I don't stop them. I let them do it. I have people who come to me, oh, I want to study this, I want to be a member of that, I want to do this and that, and then they completely don't. Sometimes they'll drop out, sometimes they'll become pains in the butts, or they'll just be argumentative, or this or that. It doesn't matter. I let them do it. Because the negative karma is actually beneficial to them. I'm not trying to be hostile, I mean, seriously not. I get no joy. I have seen someone suffer the consequences of ignoring the fact that they know better, and they still do. The issue here is that who else is going to help them? I mean, you know, so I still teach. I still do all the things that you might consider to be a spiritual teacher trying to do, even though I know that it may lead them into some negative outcome if they continue down the path of ignoring spiritual principles, certainly ignoring whatever I teach. I don't need people to do what I teach. I need people to just be virtuous. You know, that's it. The bottom line is creating virtue. That's what tonight's show is about. And if they follow these ABCs, if they come up with their own things, it's maybe counter to what I say. It's fine. But the issue here is that it doesn't bother me to see people personally suffering the consequences of their selfishness. That is not a negative to me. What bothers me is to see people hurting the potential for other people to be virtuous. That I particularly try to stand in the way of if I can, as much as I can. But a lot of times I have no way to stop that either. But if I do, I will intervene if I can. All right, I want to get into some of the other critical elements about tonight's show. What about people who encounter evil? What is evil? Remember I said I would deal with this if I had time on the show. Evil is the reverse. It doesn't want to create virtue. It wants to create darkness. So what is darkness? Darkness is the lack of God's mind, God's thought in something. And it's a continuum. So it's not just doing it one time is evil. It's the progressive and increasing level of darkness, which becomes evil. Evil is seeking to destroy God and to destroy life that is part of God, which ultimately they are. So it is eventually self-destructive. But it is over a very long time, because as you may have caught in a few minutes ago, I said that you can slow down karma enormously by becoming evil, like by a million years or up to that level. It's hard to imagine, but the greatest of the dark masters have lived in that category, like 500,000 to 1,000,000 years, because they stop their karma, and they stop disintegrating in the form that they're in, because they steal pieces of form, pieces of energy from everyone else, including other evil beings, but also from people who are just selfish. So it's a great system, because for them, they believe they're getting away with it. You see, for a long time, their consciousness is only minutely diminishing, and their form seems to be staying the same through a thing called crystallization, but in reality, it's actually the real side of it is diminishing to levels that aren't even human, they're way below human. But they don't notice it, because they fill in all the blanks with energy from others. Of course, the more they crystallize, the more they have to get power or energy from others to keep themselves alive, little. But at the same time, it looks like they are all powerful. They have a tremendous, any desire they have, they can meet, and they can be as destructive as they want to be, which is hugely so, particularly to good things, like God. I'm going to destroy God. So, The evil part of existence is the antithesis of creating virtue. It wants to make things dark. Okay, we got it. And it can do this for a very prolonged period of time, but it can't do it forever. And when it does reach a cracking point of this crystallization of its body, it has to live with whatever consciousness it has left in the bodies of plants or low forms of animal life, weird stuff, you know, for umpteen, countless lives, but it still has the consciousness that it always had. So if you could imagine being an earthworm and kind of slithering through the ground and occasionally getting eaten by a chicken or something, or a bird, the point is that, or maybe by another worm, by the way, The point is that you reach a level where you suffer immensely because the consciousness is so much greater than the form is capable of using. The person suffers from tremendous monotony and meaninglessness and sometimes pain, but also, more importantly, the suffering comes from a lack of use of consciousness, which means it keeps flowing, and it's like each part of that life and it comes back again and you start over again. But you also have the inability to create. You can't even create darkness. You can create nothing. Almost nothing. Other than a food supply, maybe, for something bigger and stronger. Just a horrible state to be in. The most horrible imaginable. And that's what eventually evil ends up being. But in the interim, evil affects many other parts of human life. That's where it tends to focus its attention. And its goal is basically to do the following. It isn't to get people to do necessarily bad things. Everybody says, oh, I've been affected by evil, I'm a terrible person. It really isn't that. It's to slow down and to stop, if possible, the creation of virtue in people that are capable of doing so. So evil's goal is not to necessarily immediately destroy somebody. They do it a little bit, a tiny bit at a time by slowing down the creation of virtue. They do it to some of the most virtuous people sometimes. Sometimes they do it to people who aren't very much so. It's easier for evil to do it with people who are creating a lot of virtue than people who aren't creating much, because then it's harder to slow it down because they aren't doing much. The people that are doing a lot of virtue are more susceptible to it if they're doing it with wrong motive in all the different ways I talked about in the show tonight. Those people are actually more open to being possessed by evil in some way. So if you're a quote-unquote, oh, I'm a spiritual disciple, and you're a member of maybe some spiritual group, you may be more open to being possessed by evil than the average guy who's just, once in a while there's something semi-virtuous for someone, sometime. But doesn't have much sense. The senseless people are not as easily possessed. I know that sounds hard to believe. We always think that that's who's real. Oh, well, it's those people who are really not very with it. That's not very good senses. They are pretty unconscious. They're easily affected by evil. No, not true. Their own ignorance, to a large extent, keeps them from becoming evil. The most susceptible people are arrogant people, who sometimes have developed a lot of different senses, usually more mundane senses, less spiritually, and sometimes are very intelligent. Certainly, they at times may have been even virtuous to a significant level and have the capability of doing much more, but usually aren't. Those are the ones that are most open to you. You could almost do a scale. And the people who have these qualities, and if you're in this category, be aware, be forewarned. If you, like I talked about 10, 15 minutes ago, if you have the ability to do more and you choose to not do so, you are open to possession by evil more so than others. Not only do you have the negative karma in your next lifetime, but possibly be born with less, which will help you to become less possessed by evil, but you're more likely to become possessed by evil in this life, or at least be affected. Possession is a mild thing sometimes. It's so minuscule you can barely notice. Possession isn't like, oh, they got me. I don't know who I am. I'm going to be. No, it's a nuance. It's a minor diversion. It's a lack for this moment or that moment when it'd be so easy, or even not so easy, but not that great an effort to be virtuous and you choose not to. Or it's where it really makes a difference and you don't do it. Because it is hard to do. But really would make a difference when you don't. Yeah. then it gets you. And you're more open to it than the folks you think aren't, are more open than you. So you don't see it coming. And the other thing is you don't see evil as well. And this is weird. Everybody says, well, oh, I'm so aware. How could I not be aware of evil? Well, if you're aware but you're not creating virtue, you're not aware of evil. That's what blinds you to it. That's how you get possessed. That's how you get evil open. You open the door because you become blind to it, and you're a victim then. There's so many ways you can be convinced something, the wrong thing is evil when it isn't, and the right thing that is evil you think is a good part of it. Oh, that's a good person. That's a good thing. That's a good cause. That's a good whatever. It's really part of evil. Yeah, for real. It really happens that way. Be cautious if you fall into this category, because you may have already been and are being used by the dark side, and you don't even know it. Don't even know it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, evil has some other, we'll call it, quirky things about it. It can communicate instantly across any part of space. I can't tell you how, but I know how, but I can't tell you. Much faster than we, zillions of times faster than the speed of light. And it does so in a way that is so surprising and so, we'll say, effective that it's very hard for virtue to move ahead in a world that has a significant amount of evil already on it, because the evil always gets a quicker answer and a more effective one in like a blitzkrieg fashion than the virtue can be created to offset it. So evil has a way of bowling over the good on a planet that already has a lot of evil on it. And we are at that point and beyond that point. Earth has been that way for some time, but it's getting worse. There's a number of issues that contribute to it. And as that happens, collectively, the world population becomes more and more blind to what evil is. And it will think things that are virtuous as being evil, and think things that are evil as being virtuous. It will reverse reality as a mass or a group, like a world mass of consciousness. Silly, crazy stuff. Dangerous. The most dangerous part of evil is that it is very hard to see, and most hard to see by those who can be most affected by it. That's the most dangerous part of evil. Second most dangerous is the overreaction by everybody, but usually the people who can't see evil, to thinking that evil is everywhere when it's almost not everywhere. It's most of the time limited in some way. By extending it to everywhere, it cuts down the freedoms of those that are trying to fight evil. And when you cut down the freedom to fight and to create more virtue, which is the outcome when you cut down freedom, virtue is cut down, and the ability to fight evil by creating virtue in certain ways is also cut down. The results are disastrous. Absolutely disastrous. Evil looks for every way possible to destroy freedom, because that's creativity. And if there's no creativity, there's no virtue. Because virtue must be created. So if you can cut down the freedom, you cut down virtue naturally. And that's what evil is trying to do every way possible. Every time you hear on the news that freedom is being diminished in some way, I don't care what it is, evil's on the rise. You don't have to be a libertarian to understand this concept. Libertarians sometimes are very sensitive to this issue, and they understand it better than other people. But it isn't really their idea. It's the idea of God. The first part of God's mind is to create. And that commensurate with that creation is an equal amount of freedom. One cannot create if the amount of freedom does not match it. So evil says, okay, we cut down the freedom. We can't do anything. They're in the astral world, really. They get people here to do it, usually through governments, but then sometimes other ways. Probably three-quarters or more of it's through government. You cut down freedom, and once you, because it's a first-rate thing, you cut down freedom. And the more you cut down freedom, you increase evil, because you decrease virtue. And then the meaning in life diminishes. And eventually, when people have less meaning, they suffer because their consciousness gets lowered. And the process just goes on and on. Less consciousness, less love. People have a field day. It says, wow, we have done it. And it starts with freedom. Move to love. Eventually becomes apathy in action. And unintelligent responses to everything. It's a waste of time and energy, and eventually tremendous forces. The evil tries to make sure affects those that would be the creators of virtue. Force those to become slaves, and you've won the world. So evil is a big deal in terms of attempting to create virtue, because you may find it in weird places and in almost any time. And you're most subjected to it if you don't reach your full level of responsibility and use the capacities that you have to the maximum level, being noble. Nobility stops evil. Ignoble. And being lacking in nobility at least allows it to exist. Now, when you lack nobility, it doesn't mean you create it more in others. You create the lack of it more in others. But you at least aren't doing it yourself. And most of the time, when you aren't doing it yourself, you are the example, and therefore it still increases others. There are exceptions to that, obviously. So in any case, the process is a means to an end. And the end is to destroy a world like Earth. And mostly they go after the physical worlds, but they also try to do the same in the astral. When it gets to the mental world, the planet no longer exists anymore. So we are partly in the mental world, about the first two of the sub planes of the lower mental world have turned into darkness. The fifth sub-world is yet to become fully dark, but it is in a battle. And right now it looks like we're on the losing end of it. So if we lose that, we're probably, the world will be, as we understand it, ended. So these are things to be concerned about, to say the least. So creating virtue is not just something you're going to be doing because, gee, I want to help this guy or that person or whatever, or I want to even help this cause or even this country, although that's a biggie. But creating virtue should be thought of as a world-saving event, a world-level event, even for those that aren't in world-saving positions or world-service positions. But every bit of it these days is of crucial need in a world that has become dark. Not like it's darker than in some other times in history, just that it's darker at a time when it should be lighter than in any time in history. And that's the danger. It's the disparity from the potential and where it is. And it's the same on a world scale as it is in an individual scale. And so the world can lose its abilities significantly, karmically speaking, in its next generation. So the next generation of people can have less capabilities to create as a world than they did in this world. We could literally be going backwards historically. We'd have a world that's like 100 years ago, or 200, 300. I mean, it can get bad. It could go back before the Renaissance. It could be the Middle Ages. It's not impossible. It has happened in times that are not historically recorded. And it has happened in historical times. What do you think the Dark Ages were about? I mean, really, we have to really look into ourselves and our own history to see how evil has managed to have its way in this world, and is still doing it. I don't want to belabor this too much further, but I do want you to realize that what we do when I speak of in creating virtue includes much more than the individual, as I presented most of the show about, but on a much bigger scale. So think about that. Now let me complete this show by getting into some of the, we'll say, the nitty-gritties that I hope you have picked up throughout the show, but kind of enumerate them so that you have, well, a definite, we'll say, planned way you can move forward. You make an assessment of your abilities. That assessment should be in two scopes. I didn't say this earlier, but it should be. It should be first, how able are you in terms of your lower self and subconscious side, your personality, in terms of selfishly creating? And how much is that in disparity to the amount that you use of your lower self, joined with your higher self and your personality, hopefully fusing with your soul, to create as a soul? Come up with a value between those. Also try to determine how much you are conscious every hour of the day. When you are conscious, you will have memory of what you did. If you can't remember two-thirds or more of the day, you need to be concerned about having a neurosis or a personality disorder, or worse, a psychosis, which again, we didn't deal with in the show. So you have some kind of psychological problem, but it is still spiritual, too. Okay? Assuming that you can remember more than a third of the hour, which I didn't have, by the way, then you at least have been conscious enough to say it's likely you haven't developed yet one of those problems. But you don't know for sure until you really evaluate this. Now remember, in your evaluation, you should go by like almost minute by minute. What did I do this minute? What did I do next? What did I do next? So that you can really put together the whole hour. It's not easy to do because you have to do some serious thinking about this. And you may, if you can't remember by the end of the day what you did at the beginning, there's a sign there's a problem. Or if you can't remember 2 hours ahead, which you did the 2 hours before, that's a problem. So it's all relative. But you use your own determination. Okay. You want to, if you can, use more and more in a progressive way for a certain period of time that you determine is reasonable to get to the point where you use enough of your senses for the service of others with humility to create virtue at a level equal to your capabilities eventually over a certain period of time. And that is determined by doing reflection and contemplation every day on how you're doing with this and getting feedback from others. They can be friends, relatives, people you don't even know that well, but people who will give you as honest an assessment as possible. And you encourage them to do that. You will also look for signs to determine how much you are helping other people to do the same thing I just said. How much are you helping them to be more conscious and to serve, to be more humble as well? You will look into your humility and to see if you are being humble in all three ways that I described, and if you are able to balance them, which gives the greatest level of humility, a sense of it, to others, so they will do the same thing. And then you will see how much of your humility gets converted into real spiritual service, meaning that 100% of the energy that you're using is going to serve others. It's not going for yourself. And that 100% becomes effortless if you can do it consistently and with you can do it once in a blue moon, it's uncontrolled. But at least it's sometimes. In the beginning, it will almost all be uncontrolled. Controlled means you can do it for more than a minute or two. It's tough. You will find it hard. Harder than you think it, I speak about. All right. And if you are in some kind of group of people who are spiritually trying to do this, you will work with them on a consistent level to spiritually discipline yourself. If you're not in a spiritual group, you'll find it much more difficult to spiritually discipline yourselves. And spiritual discipline, I didn't define that very well today, but I have other shows on it. It means that you're going to focus on one sense at a time, and eventually two or three or four together, but one sense at a time, in one body at a time, to see if you can use that sense in a purely spiritual way. That means spiritual means for the benefit of the souls of others, so that they can use it. You have to pay it forward. So you're going to try to do that. And eventually you try to do two, and then three, and then four, and eventually try to join it with one of your other body senses, until you eventually can do all of them together at the same time. You can do that, at that big, 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 big deal. Now you're becoming like a superhuman being. That's the definition of how you get there. Okay. It's best to do that with others who are doing the same, because it is so hard to do alone these days. The world is a little bit complicated to create virtue in, and very complicated to do so while you're spiritually disciplining all these bodies and senses and all this other stuff. You're going to look at your motives and try to examine them to the point where you know them, and they are pure in the sense that they are for the benefit of others and not even for your own development as of your spiritual side. Not even for that, but for the development of others and the joy that comes with it, and not for feeling good about yourself or feeling good for some other reason or getting something from other people. You're going to be very cautious in examining whether you are giving to others or seeking to take from them. Especially if you're trying to diminish their self, you're going to be most careful of that because of the personality disorder, and then you really got to fight that. That's a biggie. And if you find you're really trying to diminish the selves on a consistent basis as a sociopathic personality disorder, very seriously, then you need professional help besides, because from a psychological viewpoint, you may be incapable of seeing it beyond the most rudimentary issues. You become blind to it because it's evil. And evil hides even inside ourselves itself. And then you'll need help from others. Friends, relatives, and probably a shrink. Seriously. Okay. And if you're a psychopath, you're hopelessly beyond probably anything I'm going to say. Okay, so the other side to this is if you have excessive fears, you're going to examine those fears and recognize that they all come from the primal fear of death, which is coming from a personality which is over-controlling and has prevented yourself from developing itself. And you need to be more creative, but not in a personal sense, but in a soul sense. That's how you break that. Overcoming neurosis is best done from the spiritual side. There's no better therapy model. You can use all kinds of other therapy models that are more mundane, but you have to include that element or it really doesn't work as well in a lot of people, particularly the more developed folks. All right, so if you find that you are developing these excessive fears or you have them already, you have to challenge yourself and use the energy in your feelings of fear to create, to be of service to others. Those same energies, same desire to be of service to others. If those desires are to not make mistakes and to look better to others, especially others that in your way you may hold in some level of esteem, you must change that to a greater level of humility and at the same time use the energy to be of service by being more creative, not just more conscious, in your work and in what you do. It is the creation of virtue we are talking about, not the understanding of it. Just understanding virtue, you should have gotten that from tonight's show, especially from its title, is not good enough. And you should not relish it or accept it or pursue it. If you say, well, I'm going to meditate, I'm going to read, I'll listen to you, but I sure as heck aren't going to train anything, well, turn me off, because it isn't going to do any good to just listen. You're wasting your time. If that's what you think creating virtue is about, you will never get there. All right, so the creation of virtue requires activity or action. It involves the physical body while you're physically alive. And it means that your life is dedicated to taking chances and risks, because you will make more mistakes by being creative than just gaining some understanding. It will build consciousness, and your consciousness will grow much faster from it, because you're involving both your solar angel and your soul, and your personality is fusing with the soul while your lower self is becoming joined with your higher self. A huge improvement is taking place simultaneously in you. It must involve creation. Creation is a big risk for many people, and you've got to overcome it. Even if you don't have a neurosis, it's going to be a risk. You're going to sense it. You're going to feel some threat. You're going to have some, we'll say, trepidation moments, doubts. Even the doubt that you can do what you set your mind to do, even if you thought hours and days ago that you could do it, you may have doubts. Those doubts you sacrifice yourself for. Say, it makes no difference what happens to me. I'm doing this for others, and if I fail, at least I will have done the best I can and not given up, which is never the best. Nobility becomes the name of the game. It is not the highest virtue. It is the highest virtue a purely human person can do. As you become more of a soul, there are higher virtues than nobility. But to get to that soul, you must be noble. And you must be concerned that the non-use of your senses and the non-use of your information knowledge, regardless of what level, creates the karma of loss of such for your next life. And that's because you've diminished everybody as an example of ignobility. It is a miserable thing to do, both to yourself and others. Don't be lulled or be misled into believing that a half effort is good enough or better than no effort at all. That may not be a true statement. The truth is to be noble, to do the best you can in all actions, and the better you know it, the more you need to do it. Those that are most excused from it are the ones who truly are ignorant, not by pretending not to know or by forgetting, but who are ignorant because they have yet to experience and grow through enough lifetimes to be where the rest of the people might be, who otherwise have the ability to be greater. Ignorance is not bliss, but there is some protection. And recognize that. But don't seek ignorance as a means of protection, because that shows that you already aren't. And so that's a contradiction that will not save you from the consequences, karmically, of ignoring being noble. I hope tonight's show has put together some of the ideas that mean ways, or give you ways, of having the ABCs of creating virtue. If this has been of service, then I'm very happy. If it hasn't, well, one of us has certainly done not as good a job. The issue here is that all people can benefit from this. So share the show with others, especially people you see struggling with this. Say, this guy had a show on this. You can listen to it, and maybe it'll be of some help to you. And next week, we'll be going back to a two-hour show rather than two and a half. And I hope that tonight has made a difference to everybody, because I wanted to use the extra time we had for this topic. Well, we are out of time again. And it went by fast, and I know I spoke very quickly, because I got it. I squeezed every ounce I could into tonight's show. Forgive me if it went too fast. Until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.